Welcome, everyone, to Digital Hammurabi. I'm Dr. Josh. This is Megan. And with us today is a very, very special guest that we're very excited to have with us. And it is Dr. Francesca Stavrakopoulou. She is professor of Hebrew Bible and ancient religion in the theology and religion department at the University of Exeter, the south of England. She is very well known, not only for her work in Israelite religion, but also from the BBC series, The Bible's Buried Secrets. We're just tremendously excited to have you with us today. Thank you for coming on.
Thank you for having me. No, honestly, I'm really chuffed to be doing this. So yay. And I love your title music, by the way. I've been meaning to tell you that for ages.
It's fantastic. Yeah, it's cool. I love it.
It's an original work by Brock Benet, who is a big fan of the shows. And he donated it to us for free. He played it on
his sitar.
Yeah, his own sitar. Yeah. So
fantastic.
Yeah, he came on and did it. He's an Orthodox Jew, and he came on live one time and played it live for the opening. So it was really neat.
Wow.
Well, we always like to let our guests kind of take a couple of minutes and give a bit of their background. You can go as personal as you like, with how you got into the field, maybe your educational background, just so that everybody kind of gets a feel for who you are and what you're all about.
Yeah, okay. So obviously I now specialize in Hebrew Bible and ancient religion, particularly the material realities and social realities of Southern Levantine and other ancient Southwest Asian cultures, primarily of the Iron Age. But I got into it because I did a theology degree at Oxford University. That was my undergraduate degree. So at school, what you guys in the States call high school. So at secondary school, I did religious studies where we did stuff. That was my first kind of exposure to the study of the Bible. I didn't grow up in a religious family at all. I mean, I've never been religious at all. But I've always been really interested in ancient mythology. So particularly because of my Greek heritage, I've always been interested in the Greek myths. And so I was really into trying to work out why the hell everyone was treating Jesus so differently, when clearly in Greek myth it was perfectly normal for someone to have a deity as their father and a human as their mother. So I was just like, well, why is this Jesus dude kind of, why does he get all the attention still? And then when I was about 11, I discovered that Jesus was Jewish rather than Christian, because obviously that's, you know, quite a big discovery to make. And so, yeah, I got really interested in it. So I ended up doing a theology degree as my first degree at Oxford University, which was great. It was very kind of conventionally. It was primarily based on Christianity and its kind of biblical antecedents, and then wider Western Christianity, although I did as much Bible in that as I could. But that grounding in the Western intellectual religious tradition has been so important and valuable in my career since, because you realize just how framed intellectual paradigms are by this very Western Christianized model of understanding the past. So, you know, when I was doing like medieval Christian philosophy in my undergrad degree, I didn't realize just quite how important that kind of stuff would become. And thinking about the way in which, you know, the past was understood by some of the earliest sort of modern scientific archaeologists and some of the modern biblical commentators, and these people carry their baggage with them, do you know what I mean? They really carry that intellectual cultural baggage. So after my theology degree, I then did my I stayed at Oxford and did my master's specializing in Hebrew Bible, and then I continued on at Oxford where I did my doctorate, and that was working on King Manasseh and child sacrifice in the Hebrew Bible. So King Manasseh is like the biggest villain, the baddie of the Hebrew Bible. You know, there's nobody as bad as him. And child sacrifice is the worst practice, the worst religious thing that you could possibly do. And he's accused of performing child sacrifice. So I was really interested in that book and looking at the way in which the Hebrew Bible distorts what were the likely historical realities of the past. So we know that King Manasseh existed, for example. You know, we have Neo-Assyrian records that record his name, you know, alongside other vassals in the Southern Levant. But you know, apart from that, all we know about this guy is what's written in the biblical texts, and the biblical texts are biased. So I was looking at using history and archaeology to kind of draw a comparison between the biblical account of child sacrifice and King Manasseh and you know, the kind of try to work out what the actual historical landscape was, then to compare that to the biblical portrayals, which are very varied, and then to argue why is this character and this practice, why is it so vilified? And then that got me into you know, just more ancient Israelite religion, and I ended up doing postdocs at Oxford and teaching there for a few years, and then I moved to Exeter University, where I am now, and I've been here for too many years. I thought it would just be like one of those jobs, you know, when you get your first kind of permanent job, and you think, I'll be here for a few years and I'll go.
And I'll move on to something else.
Yeah, exactly. But then it turned out my colleagues in New Testament, massive shout out to David Horrell and Louise Lawrence, they are the most incredible people I've ever met. And it turned out to be such a brilliant environment for me. I'm the only Hebrew Bible person there. But it means that I can teach what I want. I can say what I want, do what I want, basically. You know, I'm not as restricted as I might be in other universities. So it's been great. And so I've kind of progressed, and now I've got a chair in Hebrew Bible. And I can't quite believe that I'm this old.
Please don't say things like that. We're very close to the same age. So, man, that is there is definitely something to say for you know, being in a place that you can kind of branch out as you like and set things up in a way. Yeah. you're not restricted. A lot of responsibility, but you know, a lot of that kind of freedom is it's a good feeling. So, well, I want to ask you, and Megan, you know, I will have a tendency in this to monopolize this as the interviewer, and I don't want to do that. Megan has far more fascinating questions than I do in general.
I'll butt in if I need to. But and I will say before we get going, if anyone has questions, please put them in the side chat and tag me at Digital Hammurabi. I will save them to the end and we will get through as many as we can. And we have had two super chats already. So thank you all very much. One from DTTV Science Answers for £40, who says they love Bible's Buried Secrets. This guest is fantastic. I think that is an overwhelming agreement from everyone else. And JB sends $2 and says hit that like button. So thank you very much, JB.
Sorry, did you say £40?
40, yes, I did.
I think that might be the biggest super chat we've ever received.
I think it is.
Wow, thank you very, very much. I'm telling you, you're incredibly popular. And that's what's going on. But let's, you know, for me, as I was telling you before we went live, you know, I grew up in a fundamentalist evangelical Christian household, and you know, so you know, I've got my English Bible here, and if you flip to the Old Testament, you know, you don't have to worry about things like archaeology or, you know, getting into historical sources at all. You know, like you mentioned, the New Assyrians, like who cares what they say, because we know what happened, right? And that's sort of the mentality, certainly the mentality that I had. In fact, a recent publication of a dissertation from Dallas Theological Seminary, from a good friend of mine, who comes from the same sort of background that I do, is writing about Daniel, book of Daniel. And he said, well, you know, he's talking about one of the historical problems. And he says, well, Daniel is not just another person that we, you know, figure in. He is the standard, yeah, by which we judge all other historical sources. Okay, so for those of us that came from that kind of a background, and maybe that are listening in the audience, when you say the Hebrew Bible has a bias, and maybe it's, you know, maybe it's not presenting history as it actually was, can you develop that just a little bit for us?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. Yeah. Firstly, the Hebrew Bible, you know, we have this, Christianity has an awful lot to answer for in all sorts of ways. But one of the things that early Christianity did was to, and I'm talking about Christianity in the first, you know, 3-4 centuries of its existence. One of the things that it really did was to cast the Jewish scriptures, because obviously Christianity was a Jewish movement. And it was to cast the Hebrew scriptures as proof texts for the things that Christ followers were saying about this figure. And that historicized a lot of religious literature, Jewish literature, that hadn't been historicized in quite the same way before. So almost kind of like, I'm not saying that froze it kind of, you know, froze it in plastic, you know, kind of like Han Solo in Star Wars and gets put in that whole thing. But textual traditions within, in much of the ancient world, but in Judaism up to the time of Christianity and into the early centuries of Christianity, it was incredible. These texts were incredibly fluid. They were very unstable. You just look at something like the Dead Sea Scrolls as examples of how unstable traditions were, you know, huge differences in stories about characters like Enoch, who gets barely a mention in the Hebrew Bible. He pops up in Genesis. But then, you know, the literature that was being produced around before the time of Jesus about Enoch was massive and vast. Things like, you know, even differences, you know, in the books of Samuel's that we know from the Dead Sea Scrolls, that we know from the Greek versions, that we know from the Masoretic, the Hebrew versions, are massively different. So we know that there was huge instability in these textual traditions. But what Christianity did very successfully was to cast its Messiah, its hero, as a historical figure, somebody who was going to change history, and not just kind of earthly, worldly history, but cosmic history. So things, there was a very clear sense of the past and then the present and then this apocalyptic future, because obviously all Christians were waiting for Jesus to come back and for the heavens to crash into the earthly realm. Obviously it didn't happen. But, you know, that was a major driving force for a lot of early Christian groups. But the other thing that they did was to kind of almost canonize in some ways a lot of Jewish texts. And that's the sense in which Christianity in the Western world in particular has developed over 2000 years. So it gives us this sense that we look at these ancient texts that Christians call the Old Testament. In Judaism, obviously, it's Tanakh. Scholars try to be a little bit more, use a less loaded term by referring to the Hebrew Bible rather than the Old Testament or Tanakh. But what it did was that it kind of, we look at these texts now and we think that these texts were written to be a historical record of the past, but of course they weren't. Most of the texts that we have were written a long time after the events that they seek to describe, whether or not those events are real or not, like, you know, creation in 6 days or whatever, not real. Things like the fall of Jerusalem, yeah, real, but even so, the biblical writers are telling it from their own biased perspective. And a lot of these texts were put together as they slowly began to become more authoritative in, and I'm talking about, you know, a few hundred years before Christ, as these religious texts came to be more authoritative, particularly Torah, so the first five books of the Hebrew Bible, they came to be understood as a way of trying to tell a version of the past that accounted for the present and could therefore give some kind of instruction, religious instruction, for the future. So the Hebrew Bible is inherently unreliable because it's not a primary source of evidence. You know, primary sources of evidence for the past are things like archaeology. And so what I try and do in my research and in my teaching is to emphasize that there's a difference between the biblical portrayal of the past and the likely historical reality of that past. And that likely historical reality, we can best piece it together. And obviously it's always going to be fragmentary, but we can best piece it together by using things like archaeology, anthropology, other social and scientific methods, and kind of cultural comparisons with what we know of other Southern Levantine and ancient Southwest Asian cultures, including Mesopotamian cultures, including ancient Egyptian. But that's how you build a more plausible portrait of a past society. And then you use the material remains that we have to make sense of what that means to ancient Israel and ancient Judah. And then obviously you then turn to the Hebrew Bible and say, okay, so how is this deviating? Why is it deviating? What can we tell from about the time that we think these texts were being composed or redacted and compiled? You know, what can we tell about why certain biases might be inherent in this writing? That was a very long answer to your question.
That was a beautiful answer. No, and I thank you. And to kind of develop one little thing, have you develop it just a little bit. Right at the end, you were talking about the archaeology and you know, getting at as much as we can a complete picture, or at least a more complete picture, and then taking that picture to the Hebrew Bible.
Yeah.
One of the things that I'm sure you deal with on Twitter and probably just in everyday life is a movement in the opposite direction, where you start with the biblical text, you start with the Hebrew Bible, and you say, okay, now let me go either find archaeological evidence that supports this picture, or when you find something that, you know, stands against this picture, trying to reconcile it and to say, well, I know that this stance that I have, this understanding, this picture that I've, that the Hebrew Bible has presented, must be correct. So how do we get it so that, you know, Nebuchadnezzar can actually be,
reconcile that biblical text with what we know of historical reality.
Yeah, we know Nabonidus is Belshazzar's father, but how do we get it so that Nebuchadnezzar is? Well, you know, now we go to linguistic arguments. Anyway, so, you know, can you just talk about that for a second, and maybe a way to safeguard, perhaps, because I think a lot of people in our audience do this sort of thing at like an amateur level, which is that we have some very intelligent people that watch, and they do this at an amateur level. How can they guard against doing this, taking a conclusion and trying to then incorporate the archaeological evidence or external evidence, primary sources, as opposed to building from the primary sources and then challenging the picture presented?
I mean, I think one of the most important things to do is to read widely in scholarship, if possible. I always say to my students, don't read anything on the internet. And if you're not sure about anything on the internet, just like send me the link, because there's so much shit out there, you know. And because you know, as we were talking just before we came on air, anything biblical it attracts. People are very invested in the Bible, and of course they are. Culturally, it remains a huge icon, whether we believe in its kind of religious and theological programs or not. It remains a cultural icon, and there's a sense in which we kind of think that somehow it must be reliable. But, you know, I would say the same thing, you know, imagine that this is, you're trying to reconstruct the past using the Odyssey. Would you really try to prove certain things, or, you know, interpret certain archaeological sites or artifacts on the basis of the Odyssey? Of course you wouldn't, because you recognize that this isn't just straightforward. The Odyssey isn't about straightforward history writing. I mean, I'm no expert on the Odyssey, but there are some classicist and ancient historians who like to think that it reflects late Bronze Age social practices and religious practices, and maybe there are echoes of that in there. But this in terms of what we have in as literary evidence, we have to be really careful with what, you know, we call evidence. So the best thing to do is to read scholarship widely, but also I think to think about what assumptions are you bringing to a text. None of us are without bias. I'm aware that of course I have my own bias. And I realize that one of the things I've done through my research career, my research and my publications, is I'm trying to give a voice, I realize, to those groups who appear to be vilified and marginalized in the Bible's telling of the past. So things like, you know, my lovely King Manasseh, child sacrifice wasn't that bad, you know, that kind of thing. But the way in which the Hebrew Bible writers vilify and deliberately caricature the indigenous inhabitants of the land, you know, the Canaanites, as somehow sex-crazed, unsophisticated, sort of superstitious, pagan worshippers. You know, obviously that's just ridiculous. That's not the case at all. And actually, ancient Israelite religion was Canaanites, you know, it was polytheistic. And I mean, the label Canaan is deeply problematic anyway, because, you know, what does it mean? But ancient Israelite religion and Yahweh worship itself emerged out of traditional Northwest Semitic religions that we find across the southern Levant, you know, so the things that we might call Canaanite. And so I think one of the things I've tried to do is to kind of give them a voice and say, actually, this religion was really, really deeply, it was deeply sophisticated. Polytheism, what I personally feel, was a much better system than monotheism. Monotheism now doesn't really exist anyway. I mean, you know, look at monotheisms today. They're not entirely convincing as monotheistic systems. So I think one of the things is to be aware of your bias, and then try to check that bias against the ways in which you're kind of reading texts and artifacts. And the thing about artifacts as well, you know, archaeologically speaking, very little comes out of the ground with a label on it saying, you know, made in Jerusalem, 732 BCE, you know. So contextualization is important. I'm always very suspicious of scholars who, they talk about archaeological findings and sites and immediately say, well, this must be the site of biblical, you know, so-and-so, this particular biblical town, or this must be, you know, an example of the sort of implement that we find described in, you know, Jeremiah 22 or whatever. And yeah, maybe, but that shouldn't be the first port of call. You need to look at the cultural backstory of artifacts and sites like that. You know, see what's the backstory to that. You know, if you dig back further, where do you get to? Who do you get to? So the Bible shouldn't be a primary resource in that sense.
Yeah, I mean, I think that when you, as you say, it may be the case, but when you start with that, it's difficult for the brain to then look past often something that, you know, is your initial point of comparison. So obviously this must be, I'm writing a book now on the ritual use of phonetically written texts in Sumerian, and I have an idea of why they were used. The problem is that it's difficult now that I have this idea of what they're doing. Every, you know, supporting piece of evidence, I pay really close attention to, and the ones that don't, it's harder for me to really focus in on those. And so it's difficult to do that. And I think it's really important to, you know, to be able to.
And I think you have to listen as well. When you do find things that kind of bump up against what, you know, you've been kind of working on this theory and, you know, the material evidence seems to be pointing in a direction, and then you come up against something that does bump against that, and you think, it's important to listen to that and to think, well, how, you know, it's not necessarily a corrective, but diversity in material and social evidence is just as important as diversity that we have in literary and textual evidence. And I think it is important to hear it.
I think about the Canaanites. We're having next Saturday, we're having Dr. Brendan Bentz on, who, you know, worked pretty extensively on the Canaanites. And I'm really excited that he's a super nice guy. But, you know, coming in and just trying to talk about things like we're going to talk about today with Israelite religion and talking about how is it that the Hebrew Bible, what is the Hebrew Bible doing? And I feel like that's something that we say a lot about texts on this channel. Yeah. What is the text doing? Not, you know, don't just come to it as a source of information, you know, to write down, all right, so this must be how it was. It's look behind it and see the motive behind that text. So in light of that, so everybody tune in next Saturday as well for that. But you know, in light of that, what is the Hebrew? So if we're looking at the Hebrew Bible as a tool, and not as our, you know, as our final authority, we're using it as one tool in our toolkit. What is it that we understand the Hebrew Bible to be doing when it talks about Israelite religion in the first millennium? And how does that differ from what was actually, you know, if we went back boots on the ground, had a camcorder or something, you know, how does what the Hebrew Bible, the system that the Hebrew Bible puts forward, the Old Testament puts forward, how does that differ from what was actually going on, and why does the Hebrew Bible do that?
Yeah, so the main
nice, easy question. Go.
Obviously these texts are all, you know, the Hebrew Bible is an anthology, it's a compilation that's been put together much, much later, but even so, made up of different, what were originally different scrolls and stuff. But even within those individual scrolls or books, like the Isaiah or even, you know, the Torah or whatever, they were individual textual traditions, as well as different sorts of legends and stories and poems and all sorts of things. I mean, you just look at the book of Deuteronomy, you can see that you've got these poems stuck on the end, and they do look, you know, they, lots of bits of them do look very old. So it, you know, some of that might be the oldest material that we have, but they've clearly been appended to the end of Deuteronomy because they remained authoritative and important. Culturally, religiously, they remained important. It's like kind of having like an heirloom, like passed down through the family, that you don't want to get rid of, but you don't exactly want to use it every day, but, you know, but it has to go somewhere. Yeah. So the texts were they're very composite. I've forgotten the question.
<What's> the Oh no, we were just talking about. Oh, no, go ahead. You got it.
Yeah, what are you doing? So with the caveat, important caveat, that the Hebrew Bible is a compilation and a very kind of varied compilation over several centuries and lots of different groups, scribal groups that have worked on these texts. With that proviso in mind, you can see that there has been a move, and probably starting sometime around the 6th century to the 5th century BCE, when the agenda, religious agenda, was very much to present the religious past as having always been properly monotheistic. So in other words, Yahweh was always only the ever true God. So not that there weren't other gods. Biblical writers are very comfortable about, you know, acknowledging that there were other gods, but that, you know, Yahweh is the only God, that monotheism is, has a pedigree that goes right the way back to before creation. And the, in the story of God's, you know, Yahweh's relationship with his people, the Israelites, who obviously start off as Mesopotamians because of Abraham. And, you know, so there's this, he comes out of Mesopotamia. So there's this sense that Yahweh's relationship with him, with them, has always been he's insisted that I will be your deity. I will, you know, look after you. I will grant me fertility and protection. I will fight for you, on the condition that you worship me and me alone. And so the biblical story, as we read, particularly through the Torah and then the so-called historical books, so the books of, you know, Joshua, Judges, Samuel, Kings, that once the people got into the land, into the promised land, their religion was corrupted by the indigenous Canaanite polytheism. And that this is the thing that caused all the problems. And so this is why Yahweh keeps kicking off and shouting at his people, and then eventually decides to punish them by bringing in first the Assyrians and then the Babylonians. And then, you know, later on, then obviously the Greeks. Yay, the Greeks. So, yeah, but there's a sense in which there's an ideology that's working throughout a very careful redactional layers, if you like, in certain biblical texts, that's trying to insist that Yahweh worship Yahweh is the only one true God, no other deities. He's the creator God. He's the God responsible for animal and human and agricultural fertility. He's the God who's the warrior deity. But the reality is massively different, you know, archaeologically, and even from some of those very ancient bits of poetry and other traditions that we find in the Hebrew Bible. The reality was different in that we know that ancient Israelite religion was polytheistic, was normatively, traditionally polytheistic, and that this sense of Yahweh alone wasn't widely shared, you know, didn't emerge until, some scholars say, 8th century BCE. I think that's pushing it. I think that's being far too positive, because they kind of phrase, you know, they link it around King Hezekiah, who supposedly purged the Jerusalem temple cult. Some sort of scholars say, no, it's 7th century, you know, it's the time of King Josiah, who's the great reforming king. Yeah, again, ridiculous, I think, personally. So it looks like the period when the Jerusalem temple is first destroyed, you know, so why is, you know, and when a temple was destroyed, it was all about, you know, you had, worshippers had various different responses to this. Theologically, how do you deal with this? So quite normatively, and as we see in Sumerian texts and Assyrian texts, it would be simply, well, the deity has abandoned his or her temple. They're pissed off, like, because you've done something wrong. They're pissed off, so they've abandoned the temple, and they're not going to help you. So if the deity abandons the temple will fall. And so that's the most common theological response to the fall of the Jerusalem temple in about 587 BCE at the hands of the Babylonians. And so we find that a lot of the biblical, you know, the Hebrew scribes are saying it's Yahweh's abandoned Jerusalem because it's a punishment for our sins. Well, what were our sins? Oh, maybe it's because we worshipped all those other gods, because we weren't being committed enough to him. This is a deity who demands exclusive worship. And that's the kind of polemic that was very common anyway. You find that all over ancient Southwest Asia, that deities demand exclusivity. But there it didn't quite function in that way. You know, you can talk about it's not monotheism in the sense that all deities demanded certain exclusivity, but they knew they were working. They knew, like, they existed, but, you know, the deities knew they were working they were bound into a social network of gods, just as their humans were bound into their own social networks. So in a way, the biblical response to the destruction of the Jerusalem temple is, oh shit, you know, Yahweh's pissed off. we can't worship any other gods, so we should just worship him. But that was quite a traditional response anyway. But because the biblical texts are the work, not they're not representative of the religious land, the whole religious landscape. They're the work of urban scribal elites, primarily coming out of places like Jerusalem. And then because they're elites, they're taken off to Babylon in exile. So they're not representative of what most people were doing and the way they were worshipping and all the different deities they were worshipping. But the result is that we have this very biased, very slanted view that Yahweh was a God who always demanded exclusive worship and that this is the way that he ought to be worshipped. But the reality was massively different. The reality was polytheism, quite sensibly.
Yeah. You know, I wrote my dissertation on actually those types of temple laments in Sumerian, you know, so, you know, if
any... God, they're heartbreaking, you know, they're just
You know, and so if anything's going to be done, if a statue of a deity is going to be taken out on procession, or if they're going to rebuild the wall, you know, a mud brick wall or something of the temple, the gala priest, you know, the one that's responsible to for appeasing the heart of the deity, he recites these laments, these emissal Sumerian prayers, and what they do, and I know you know this, but I mean, like, they describe, just for the audience, they describe all the horrible things that will happen ostensibly if the deity gets pissed off and leaves and abandons them. And it's terrible, the things that happen. This idea of you know, looking back and going, well, he's gone, you know, and I think of Ezekiel. Yeah, that's the first, you know, prophet that comes to mind when I think about that. And, you know, him being picked up by the hair and taken back, and he digs through the wall, you know, and he looks and he sees all the horrible things that are going on, the worship of Tammuz and the sun and whatever. So in light of that, what, I asked a really broad question the last time, but I want to do it again. But I really want you to just, I want you to have the freedom to, because, like, this is your thing. Like, so go wherever you want to go with it. But what was religion like? I'm thinking the thing that always comes to mind is that Abecedary, I think, from Cantilla d'Ajrud, with, you know, the drawing there of Yahweh and his Asherah. So, like, what was religion like? What, you know, I don't want to say like the average person, but I mean, you said that Yahweh wasn't always this, you know, God that demanded exclusivity. What was it like, sort of, whatever you want to talk about with respect to that? Great.
But given that, most of what we know comes from, biblical text in that sense, you know, most of the detail of stuff that was, some detail coheres in the Hebrew Bible. Asherah is the name of a goddess, but is vilified, you know, but there's lots of references to a statue of Asherah being in the Jerusalem temple. And we know externally, you know, from external evidence, like the inscription from Cantilla d'Ajrud, which talks about Yahweh and his Asherah. We know that Yahweh and Asherah were paired together. Yahweh was the state deity, but state deity doesn't necessarily mean kind of the official deity. It just simply means politically, you know, the patron deity of the King of Jerusalem, for example. So Yahweh was the kind of the head deity, and it looks like he had a partner deity, Asherah, which is completely normal because, as I said, Israelite and Judahite religion was a subset of broader Northwest Semitic religions. And we know from Ugaritic texts, so from the late Bronze Age, we know that Asherah was the wife of the head god there. Ugarit was a city-state with this incredibly brilliant, it was a very wealthy, prosperous city for a long time. But its pantheon looks very similar to the sorts of flashes you get of pantheon in the Hebrew Bible. So rather, Ugarit, Ael was the high god, and Asherah was his wife, Athira, as she's called in Ugarit. But then you had like a second tier of deity. So these are the active gods. Ael and his wife were kind of semi-retired, you know, kind of like just letting the younger generation do their thing. So the younger generation were gods like Baal, a storm god and a warrior god, and Anat, his sister, who's amazing, like totally kick-ass. And we know that she was worshipped by Yahweh worshippers, because we found archaeologically sort of arrowheads with her name written on them in sort of Israelite sites. Her name appears weirdly only a couple of times in the Hebrew Bible, but a lot of her signature moves, if you like, kind of smashing skulls and trampling corpses and that kind of stuff, a lot of her signature moves are applied to Yahweh in the Bible. So it looks like he inherited those sorts of things, you know, from his older, what's basically his older cultural cousin. So Anat was a kick-ass deity as well. You had other gods and goddesses, like, you know, you had Mot, who the underworld deity, you know, or death, you know, is he a god or is he not? He kind of looks to be. You had Yam, who is the god of the sea. You find these similar sorts of personalities in the Hebrew Bible. You find glimpses of what looks to be this inherited religious tradition that seems to have played a big part in the development of Yahweh worship. But by the time we get to the Hebrew Bible, Yahweh has kind of taken on a lot of the roles and functions and even the name of El. He's taken his wife, Asherah, it would seem, by the time he gets to the Iron Age, historically speaking. So we know that it was far more pluralistic and polytheistic than the Bible would have us believe. So when the Bible's saying, oh, you know, you terrible Israelites, you keep setting up the high places, you know, the Bar Mots, the high places, that, you know, this is references to other temples. And archaeologically, we know that there were lots of other temples all over the place, not just Jerusalem, not just Samaria. So when we find bits of archaeology that attest to this much richer, much more textured mythological and religious landscape, then, you know, we prioritize that and say, well, actually, that makes better sense of texts that we read in the Hebrew Bible. So, for example, in the book of Jeremiah, there's this really weird couple of chapters, in chapters 7 and chapters 44, in which Jeremiah, who's supposedly a 6th century prophet, so the Babylonians have invaded, the first lot of elites have been exiled, some have rushed off to Babylon, some have, you know, gone off to Egypt. And, you know, Jeremiah is still, like, you know, wandering around Jerusalem shouting at people, like prophets tend to quite often to do. And he's writing letters back and forth to people in Egypt, and he's saying to the Egyptians, you know, why are you worshipping the Queen of Heaven? And they're from Jerusalem, they're elites in Jerusalem, and they say, we worship the Queen of Heaven because when we're in Jerusalem and we worship the Queen of Heaven, we had everything, you know. They say we had food security, we had prosperity, we had no threat of the sword. And so this kind of goddess figure, you kind of get a glimpse of a tradition in which there was a very powerful goddess in Jerusalem, who perhaps was Asherah. Most probably, if she's the Queen of Heaven, you kind of think she would be the partner to the Yahweh, the King of Heaven. So you do get little glimpses, but they're like refractions, like distorted reflections, rather than direct kind of mirroring of the past. So you get that stuff. But things like that, like the goddess Asherah, I mean, she was incredibly important. And the very fact that we have not just this reference to Yahweh and Asherah from Kuntzlet Ha-Druz, but we have inscriptions that say the same thing from other sites, including tombs, high status tombs. You know, these were kind of wealthy political Jerusalem elites living in and around the capital city, and they had kind of landed estates with, like, you know, vineyards and olive groves and stuff. These are like wealthy people, and they're leaving, you know, they're having inscriptions written in their tombs that are asking for Yahweh and Asherah to look after them in the afterlife. I mean, she was clearly a hugely important deity. And yet, if you were just to rely on the Hebrew Bible, you'd think she was some awful foreign deity, that, you know, some kind of awful superstition. But actually, she was, you know, really important. And her role was probably to act as the main mediator between worshippers and Yahweh himself. You know, her job was to kind of mediate between, mythologically, between gods in the polytheistic system, but also in terms of ritual, to mediate between worshippers and Yahweh when they were trying to appeal to him. So she was super cool. I keep going off on tangents, but I think
it's wonderful. Like,
what my lectures are like. My students are like that. What is she talking about?
let me ask you this, because
the best lectures tend to take off slightly odd directions. They're always the most interesting ones.
Oh, I hope so.
Well, so one of the other places that it'd be interesting to hear your perspective on, I think Richard Averbeck read an article. Remember how long ago he wrote it, but talking about glimpses of you know, Ugaritic mythology and these types of chaos battle scenes. Of course, that we see it Ugarit, we see them, you know, in the Enuma Elish in you know, Mesopotamia. But you see some of these things in the Psalms, you know, sort of reflections of that. See it a little bit in Job. But could you talk about that, and then maybe its appearance, maybe in a demythologized form, and if you could say all that in a much more understandable way for everybody, that would be great. In Genesis, in Genesis 1 in particular.
Yeah. So what you're referring to is kind of, is broadly known as the kind of the Chaos Kampf theories. This idea that one of the common features in the mythological landscape across ancient Southwest Asia was this idea of a battle between a warrior deity or a group of warrior deities and some kind of monstrous sea deity. So obviously in Enuma Elish, it's Tiamat, who weirdly, you know, who is obviously one of the oldest goddesses and kind of goes through this interesting shape-shifting throughout Enuma Elish. You know, in which like one minute she's like this kind of scaly sea serpent, the next minute she's like this amniotic sac of kind of primeval fluid, and the next minute she's like this ferocious woman. I mean, that mythological text itself is hugely misogynistic in all sorts of ways, as we know. But so, you know, we've got examples of it in Enuma Elish, but also obviously that's a later example in terms of Mesopotamian history. You know, we've got much earlier examples, like little hints in some of the very earliest Hittite mythology. And obviously we find it at Ugarit, in which the battle between the warrior deity and the sea, the kind of chaotic forces of the sea. Sometimes it's told in the battle between Baal and Yam, but we also have Anat, Yam's sister, you know, who says that she's the one that smote the twisting serpent, you know, in the sea. She's the one that bound the many-headed encircler. So it's this seven-headed sea monster, basically, and that in Ugaritic mythology. And that's exactly what we find in texts that we find in Isaiah and in Job and in the Psalms. And people tend to think that, you know, well, what's this myth doing? And it seems to be playing a part in a creation tradition. Creation was never a one-off event in ancient mythology. You know, people think that like you create and then you've done it and it's fine, but ancient mythological ways of thinking were so different. They weren't linear. And they weren't even cyclical. They kind of like fold in and twist around on each other. That's kind of the point of mythology. That's what kind of keeps the gods alive in a way. So that you can have a god like Baal be killed by the god Mot, death, and be buried in his tomb. And then, wow, 3 days later, he comes back to life and resurrects. We can talk about that another time if you like. obviously, that's quite important in the grand scheme of world history. But yeah, so like in that Ugaritic myth in which you have this kind of fight with the sea monster, we find echoes of that same mythic trope in the Hebrew Bible. And we tend to think that this is, you know, this was probably another way of talking about creation. As I said, creation wasn't just a one-off event. But we always think, oh, you know, creation in the Bible. Oh, right. Genesis, the world was created in 6 days and then, you know, bang. Or there's another story next door to Genesis, which is that God plants a garden and then makes the man and then pulls, you know, then makes several animals as a sexual partner for Adam before Adam's like, you seriously, dude, this is not doing it. and then he makes the woman. But we only think that that's the kind of the ancient Israelite creation myth because it's at the beginning of Genesis and because that ended up in the beginning of our canonical Bibles. So it looks like these myths about God having a massive fight with a sea dragon that we see in Job and Psalms and Isaiah, that probably was the much more powerful creation myth associated with Yahweh, at least. And in some of those myths, it's a really physical, you know, there's a real sense of a physical fight. In Psalms, it talks about Yahweh smashing the heads, plural, this seven-headed creature, smashing the heads of the dragons. And then by the time you get to the book of Job, Yahweh's like much more hands off. The writer of that particular poetic cycle in Job is really keen to try and distance Yahweh from the sense that he's got any kind of direct competitor, you know, in terms of sheer physical strength. And so in the poetic cycle in Job, when he's talking about Yahweh's fight with the sea dragon, who is called Leviathan, in that text, another biblical text, you know, Yahweh's like, yeah, well, you know, can you trap it? You know, can you catch it on a hook? So the way that Yahweh defeats the dragon there is like he's just gone fishing. Whereas in Psalms, he's like smashing his head in. He's having to physically fight. So Job is like, oh, no, you know, Yahweh just threw a fishing net over him. He just like caught him on a hook. And then by the time you get to something like Genesis 1, which has been so stripped of its kind of mythological meat, you kind of just get this sense, oh, yeah, and Yahweh created the great sea dragons that are in the water. You know, that's in chapter 1. So he's like, they've become creatures. And then the rabbis themselves, they play on this idea, the early rabbis. So in Psalms, it talks about Yahweh created Leviathan to kind of to play in the sea. And then early rabbis start to talk about the fact that, you know, what, how did God spend his days? And they divide up God's day into like different parts, you know, morning and then afternoon. And what Yahweh likes to do in the evening is to spend time playing with his sea dragon. It's his pet. So there's this like incredible sense in which the idea of this chaos monster was so deeply rooted in the cultural and religious DNA of Yahweh worship that you can't just get rid of it. Even when monotheism supposedly mm-hmm. has come about, it doesn't just disappear. So it gets reshaped and kind of rehandled. So you start with this massive seven-headed dragon and Yahweh's having to like punch it in the face.
Yeah.
Which is a great image. I can never get out of my head. And then obviously that seven-headed dragon reappears in the book of Revelation, you know, towards mm-hmm. the end, another big fight with dragons and stuff. But then you end up like with the rabbis saying that, you know, the Lord of the Leviathan was Yahweh's pet and that he liked to play with. And then they start talking about the fact that, you know, that he captured Leviathan and he kind of kept it in a watery store cupboard. And that at the end of days, he's going to kind of open up the watery store cupboard, bring out Leviathan, kill it, and serve it up as this kind of apocalyptic feast for worshippers at the end. So this sea dragon, you know, you kind of think, what dragons in the Bible? But like, it's one of the most important kind of parts of Yahweh's story, if you like, for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years. So that's of how, like, you know, Canaanite mythology ends up in the Bible.
It's really interesting that kind of development. You know, you see it also in you know, Mesopotamian mythology. So, Ninurta earlier on in the second millennium, you know, he fights against the Anzu bird who has the Tablet of Destinies, and he loses, and then he's got to get advice, and then he goes back again, and he's able to trick the person that has the Anzu bird who has the Tablet of Destinies to win. But it's not like by sheer might that he wins; it's by you know, cunning. By the time you get to the Enuma Elish, you know, Marduk
just throws some wind at it. And
He's approaching, I mean, well, even before, like, as he's approaching Kingu, who's holding the Tablet of Destinies, he's just defeated by his approach. You know, so this idea of development of might and of power borrowing from this tradition, it's fascinating to see.
And what's interesting about it, too, is that you see it exactly the same kind of development in biblical and Mesopotamian theology, is that if you look at something like Enuma Elish, the way that Marduk defeats Tiamat, I mean, obviously there's a lot of physical grappling, you know, and he's like got all, he's got deluge and he's, you know, firing arrows and stuff. But it's also with words, you know, Marduk's speech that ultimately defeats Tiamat, just as in the same way that, you know, Yahweh is so powerful that all he has to do in Genesis is to speak creation being, you know, and it's that sense in which somehow words become, you know, and partly because they're magic, but also because these are scribes that are producing this stuff. It's in their interest to big up the written word. And so there's this sense in which somehow the more emphasis you have on a kind of a written and a kind of an uttered religion or ritual or magical spell or whatever it is, then the more hands off the deities themselves become. They become less willing in mythology, in kind of mythology, to kind of get their hands dirty.
Yeah.
And in fact, just as a little plug, I've written about this quite a lot in a book that's coming out. My first book for non-academic audiences, for some non-specialists, is coming out next year. And it's An Anatomy of God, in which I kind of talk about how Yahweh changes from this bodied deity into the kind of the weird idea of God that we have today. But I deal with some of that, the way in which there's a deliberate kind of reduction of this very material bodied deity, and that you can see some similar tendencies in other ancient Southwest Asian religions as well. So, but yeah, that's just a little plug.
Do you want to take a second and just kind of tell people where they can find you and, you know, anything else that you kind of want them to look at?
Well, no, I'm just, this has been nice because I've been in lockdown for so long. It's just really nice to talk.
Well, we'll see you tomorrow then. This will be great.
Look out for the book next year. It's called God and Anatomy. And it's even got pictures. And it's very graphic. And I've loved writing it. But it's been the hardest thing I think I've ever written. Far harder than writing scholarship. Because I'm, you know, I have to explain stuff in some ways to a scholarly audience. But this has been a challenge. But I've loved writing it. You can find me on Twitter. What am I? At Prof. Francesca. And there's all sorts of my stuff out there on YouTube.
Well, I have thoroughly enjoyed this, probably more than anyone should enjoy an interview. So thank you very much for coming on and engaging with us on this.
Thank you for having me.
Well, we look forward to having you back. Until next time, resist poor scholarship. Always ask, how do you know that?